It's a really nice view. Just to see you all. And sincerity. It touches me. It touches us. The Sangha, the community. I trust some of you know the story that Ananda was an attendant to the Buddha. And also this amazing memory that memorized every teaching that the Buddha taught. That's why when you read the canonical literature, the first line often is, "Thus have I heard," and that was actually Ananda repeating what he had heard of the Buddha's teachings. But one time there was a big gathering, and Ananda was looking around, and he told the Buddha, he said, "Gosh, the community is like half of the holy life." And the Buddha smiled and said, "Ananda, the community is the whole of the holy life." I just love that sense of family, community, like mind-heartedness. And so, we've moved in quite a bit into our first day of practice. And I know it's such a, for many, a very big lifestyle change. And it does take some time to settle. And so I just want to normalize. Actually, there's a Buddhist monk. He wrote a book called Mindfulness in Plain English. His name is Bhante Gunaratana. It's a wonderful book. And in that book, he says that your mind is like a madhouse barreling down the hill, utterly out of control and hopeless. Does that sound familiar? But he goes on to say with some hopefulness that no problem, it's not any different than it was yesterday. Perhaps you just haven't noticed. And so perhaps we're beginning to notice this madhouse on wheels barreling down the hill, utterly out of control. And the gift of our mindfulness practice is that when we see that we are not present, we are present, and we're priming that pump that I was mentioning earlier, that we can begin to build our concentration and its manual labor. Sometimes it's very helpful to reflect upon what brings us to this practice as a form of inspiration.
Are you recording, Bob?
Yes. Thank you. And what brings us to this practice, the inspiration that brings us here, because it's really, to me anyways, more and more mysterious as time goes on. And I remember once Jack Kornfield saying, he said, "When I was young, I didn't believe in everything, in anything. When I was young, I didn't believe in anything. And now that I'm older, I believe in everything." And so I think as time goes on, the mystery prevails. And I used to have a Zen teacher, Bishop Nipu Sayaku, who I very much loved. And he had this beautiful saying. He said that every day I know less and less. Someday I'll know nothing. It's kind of like that's like kind of like graduate school. Someday I'll know nothing. But he did know something. He knew a lot, and his area of Zen was the Majjhimika Karika by Nagarjuna, which is this amazing and complex and profound teaching. And within that teaching, and I remember Bishop Sayaku often saying to me, and this might sound abusive, but it's not. But he would look at me with a smile on his face and say, "Bob, you're the stupidest person I've ever met in my entire life." But he had this smile on, and he had, of course, his robes and a shaved head, and you know, there wasn't a feeling of him trying to belittle me. It was kind of like a little teaching exchange that he would exchange with me from time to time. And so then my response was, "Why am I so stupid?" And he'd smile and he'd go, "Because you're already enlightened. You just don't know it." And I've stayed with that for now. This was in the late 70s, so it's a long time ago, 30, 40 years. It's amazing how that sometimes these little teachings kind of just for me anyways, continue to work on me. And I've come to understand in that teaching that I really believe that he really could see inside me something that I wasn't able to see then, and maybe I barely can see now, but I'm maybe open to the possibility that maybe there's something inside that's awake. It's a beautiful offering to offer to someone. Like, I see this in you. Even if you don't see it, I see it in you, the seed of awakening. And he had his own unique way of saying it. Bob, you're just so stupid because you're already enlightened. You don't even know it. And but anyways, deep bows to Bishop Nipu Seyaku, who I really, deep in my heart, it's kind of like a Dharma daddy. What brings us here? Rod McClaver, just read a little bit of this. He goes, why do we exist? It's a great question. The perennial question of the ages. Why do we exist? From a science point of view, he says, there's 50 trillion cells that make up the human body, and each of those cells, in turn, consists of atoms, countless millions or billions of them, depending on the function of a specific cell. And of the atoms, well, they consist mostly of empty space. Protons and neutrons surrounded by electrons, empty space, just as the universe is mostly empty space. So thus this body, this human body, this entity, is mostly made of empty space. But it's a space held together, for the time being a space unified, even for a little while, by a life force. These atoms existed before the human body, and they will exist after this life is gone. But in the meantime, in this short interval, these atoms are held together in an indescribable and unknowable force, just pointing to this mystery. It's pretty mysterious. We have a friend who's a particle physicist at UCSC, and he says, as you look deep down into things, he actually wrote a book, I think it's called Deep Down Into Things, like things don't follow the natural order and sequences. It gets very mysterious in subatomic particles, quarks, different things. That, like, it's mysterious. Like, what is this? So that's on the very specific microscopic level. And then on the opposite, the macroscopic level, I have an older son that is went to school has a degree in astrophysics, and his particular area is dark energy. Now, if you ask him what's dark energy, he'll say, we don't know. So there you go. It's like the mystery again. We don't know. But somehow dark energy, which was actually discovered at Berkeley in the late 1990s, that it's some type of unknowable force that somehow is expanding the universe. And how they can tell is by these supernovas that are kind of like buoys in the ocean. So just think of like the macro size of this, that supernovas are just like buoys, they're markers. And you can measure from one supernova to another, and somehow you can measure with a lot of math and observation and pictures the universe is expanding. But then I asked him, well, what do you mean the universe? Isn't the universe just boundless, and how can it expand into, like, it's just, we don't know. So it's just this not knowing of things. Oops. So it's powerful to be in the mystery. And I trust all of us, if we remember very early in our lives, I remember for me, like, asking my mother, like, why is the sky blue? What happens after death? These marvelous questions of a child, of like, you know, what is this? And then, of course, we get our conditioning and education, and we inhabit this world. And of course, we need to inhabit this world. And at times, the mystery gets lost unless there's some wake-up calls to begin to have us begin to realize, like, what is this? Who are we? I love that in Mary Oliver, she writes in The Summer Day, she asks these beautiful questions like a child, like, who made the world? That's a good question. Could we pause long enough to just sit with that? Who made the world? Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made the grasshopper? And then she goes on to speak about a grasshopper. This grasshopper, I mean, the one who's eating sugar out of my hand. Slow it down just to see, be with a grasshopper eating sugar out of your hand. And who's moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down. Who's gazing around with her enormous and complicated eyes. And now she lifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face and then snaps her wings open and floats away. Kind of miraculous the way she describes this simple, amazing thing. Who is a grasshopper? She goes on to say, I don't know exactly what a prayer is, but I know how to pay attention and to fall into the grass, to kneel down, to be idle, to stroll through the fields, which was what I've been doing all day long. Tell me, what else should I have done? It's a good question. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Yeah. That's humbling. Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Just these, read these two little poems in between the ending of Mary Oliver, Time as a Dressmaker's. It says, time is a dressmaker. It specializes in alterations. And everything takes longer than you think it should or thought it would, except your life. So Mary Oliver again speaks about, tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? And tell me, what is it that you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? I love all the questions in this poem. What is it that you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? And so here we are in this retreat, creating some time and space to perhaps sit with some of these questions, or just sit with our hearts, sit with our bodies, sit with our mind. And things begin to emerge. Saraha writes that within my body are all the sacred places of the world. Within my body are all the sacred places of the world, and the most profound pilgrimage I can ever make is within my own body. The most profound pilgrimage I can ever make is within my own body. Perhaps that's what we're beginning to embark upon. what brings us to practice. I know prior to leave, for me personally, and I know some of you know the story, that when I was 4 years old, riding in the back seat of my parents' car, we were driving down Corey Hill Road in Brighton to go to my grandmother's house, my Nana's house in Brookline. And I was just sitting in the back seat. I was the oldest son, so that my brother had not yet. Actually, my brother must have been born. He must have been about 1 year old. And but we were driving to my Nana's, and I don't know if my parents were talking about something or not, but I unmistakably had this, like a lightning bolt realization that I and everyone was going to die and that it could happen at any time. That's a powerful moment. I know it in some ways changed my life, this recognition of it's not going to last. And I trust some of us here may also remember that moment when you knew it was not going to last. And if you're just finding out today for the first time, well, I'm sorry. that's what's going to happen. It's powerful to realize that, though. Time. There's no guarantee in time. I remember asking my teacher, Lhendit Sero, Burmese forest monk, when on his 80th birthday, how fast has 80 years gone by? And he looked at me and smiled, and he answered like this. 80 years. 80 years. Of course, at that time, I was in my early 40s, and I thought he was really old. Well, I'm now 70. Remember once my wife sharing with me something of a story when she was teaching an MBSR class, that on the first night people go around the circle and they share about what brings them to the class, and it is something like this, but the person said, well, the last thing I remember, I was 22 and I'm now 44. Like, this time is, again, like this dressmaker, and it has all these alterations because we don't know. Jane Kenyon, she writes that I got out of bed in two strong legs. It might have been otherwise. I ate cereal, sweet milk, and a ripe, flawless peach. It might have been otherwise. I took the dog uphill to the birch wood, and all morning I did the work that I love, and at noon I lied down with my mate. It might have been otherwise. We ate dinner together at a table with silver candlesticks. It might have been otherwise. And I slept in a bed in a room with paintings on the walls, and I planned another day, just like this day. But one day, I know it will be otherwise. One day, I know it will be otherwise. This life, so fragile and so precious, and perhaps this is what brings us here. We're taking, it's so amazing that we have given ourselves permission and, of course, support with our benefactors of family, friends, community that are supporting us so that we can be here to sit with these, to sit with our lives, with our hearts, the fragility, the preciousness. And I trust that every one of us here, as Miller Williams, poet, says, you don't know what's going on way down there where the spirit meets the bones, where no eyes have seen and no ears have heard. And he asks to have compassion, and we have compassion. So with all of us here, we don't know what's going on way down there where the spirit meets the bones, where no eyes have seen and no ears have heard. So interesting, as we look in the normalcy of our life, you know, it's just like we're in a town square and there's a coffee shop and there's people sitting there and this and that. I remember seeing this very very wise creative video of a little video of people in like the coffee shop in different places, and you can just see them sitting there drinking a coffee or doing this or doing that, and then this little bubble up over the head. I'm worried about my wife. I don't know if I have enough money. I mean, there's all these bubbles of like, wow, like what's going on in the deeper level with all of us. So wonderful to come on retreat, to be with our hearts, with our fears, our joys, sometimes known as the 10,000 sorrows and 10,000 joys. But this life's just so precious and fragile. This is a very poignant story. Supposedly was written by a New York City taxi driver. It speaks to the poignancy, to the fragility, to the preciousness, to the mystery of life. It says, I arrived at the address and I honked the horn. And after waiting a few minutes, I honked again. Well, I decided that I would put the car in park since the person didn't come out, and walk up to the front door, and I gave it a knock, and then I heard, like, it sounded like a frail and elderly voice saying, just a minute. And then I could hear something being dragged across the floor. And after a long pause, the door opened, and there in front of me was a small woman in her 90s, it seemed like. And she was wearing a print dress and a pillbox hat with a veil pinned on it, like somebody out of a 1940s movie. And by her side, there was a nylon suitcase. And the apartment looked as if no one had lived in it for a long time. Furniture was covered with sheets. There were no knickknacks or utensils on the counters, no clocks on the walls. In the corner, there was a cardboard box filled with photos and glassware. She looked at me and said, will you please carry my bag out to the car? So I took the suitcase, and then I returned to assist the woman, and she took my arm, and we walked slowly to the curb. She kept thanking me for my kindness, and I said, it's nothing. I try to treat all my passengers the way I would want my mother to be treated. She said, you're such a good boy. When we got in the cab, she gave me an address. And then she said, could you drive me, though, through downtown? And I said, well, it's not the shortest way. She says, I don't mind. I'm in no hurry. I'm on my way to a hospice. I looked in the rearview mirror. Her eyes were glistening. She went on to say, I don't have any family left. The doctor says, I don't have very long. I just quietly reached over and I shut off the meter. What route would you like to take? I asked. And for the next 2 hours, we drove through the city. She showed me the building where she had once worked as an elevator operator. We drove through the neighborhood where she and her husband had lived when they were newlyweds. She had me pull in front of a furniture warehouse that had once been a ballroom where she had gone dancing as a girl. Sometimes she'd ask me to slow in front of a particular building or a corner, and she'd just sit there staring into the darkness, saying nothing. As the first hint of the sun began to rise, she said, I'm tired. I think it's time to go now. So off we went. Parked the car, and two orderlies came out, came to the cab, and seemed to be expecting her, though late. I opened the trunk, and I took a small suitcase to the door, and the woman was already seated in a wheelchair, and she asked me, how much do I owe you? As she was reaching into her purse, and I said, nothing. But you have to make a living, she answered. There'll be other passengers, I responded. And almost without thinking, I just bent down and I gave her a hug, and she held on to me tightly. And she said, you just gave an old woman a little moment of joy. Thank you. I squeezed her hand and then walked off into the dim morning light. It felt behind me as if a door got shut, like a sound of a closing of a life. I didn't pick up any more passengers that shift. I just drove aimlessly, lost in thought. For the rest of that day, I could hardly talk. On quick review, I don't think I've done anything more important in my life. Always, reading always gets me a little bit with little tears. It really describes this tenderness, this fragility, this preciousness of this life. There's a teaching in the Dharma on what's known as the four heavenly messengers. And it's quite an interesting name, because the messengers are aging, illness, death, and the potentiality of awakening. They might not at first sound so heavenly. But I wanted to share with you a little bit of this story, and that these messengers can have a way of waking us up. And this is the story of Siddhartha Gautama, who later became known as Gautama Buddha, the Buddha. But this is his story. And I've told this story many times, and I still feel so touched by it. Because I think it's such a human story that I think that for many of us we can relate to. Yes, we've had different conditions and different upbringings, and probably none of us here were literally, maybe you were told you're a prince or you're a princess, but in Siddhartha's case, he was a prince destined to become a king. Of course, all of these little of our little children, they are these princesses and princes and beautiful beings that are extraordinary. But Siddhartha was born into this family, a royal family, and was destined to become a king. And it was very customary in ancient India, and even to this day, where after a baby was born, a few holy people would come and look at the baby and offer some predictions for the future. They would look at the length of the arms, the complexion, the ears, different types of anatomical, different gestures, mannerisms, and when the moon was, and this and that. And anyways, these five holy people came, and four of them said, Siddhartha will definitely become a world-turning monarch king, a great, great king. But the youngest one, and his name was Kodanya, he said, no, your son's going to become a Buddha. And when the king heard this, it really, even though this was the youngest, and what does this person know? The other four are very esteemed, and they know a lot, and they say he's going to be king. But somehow, when he heard from Kodanya that his son was going to become a Buddha, it got him filled with a lot of fear and apprehension. And so he made an intention, the king, to shield his son from seeing any of the woes of the world. There was palaces for each season. There was pleasure palaces and sports palaces and education palaces. I mean, he had a life of pleasure and fun. And this went on for 29 years. Oh, And it is said that in his 29th year, I don't know, something happened with Siddhartha, and he began to realize that he hadn't spent much time being out in the kingdom where the people live, and had an interest to go out and just to see how the people live in the kingdom. And so he asked his charioteer's person, Chana, to join him, to have actually Chana take him out into the kingdom and to see how people live. And so on this first outing, the story goes, he's, you know, seeing the people in the marketplace and all types of things going on. And then he came across this very aged person that looked very different than his young, beautiful presence and people in the palace and so forth. And he asked Chana, who is this? And Chana said, this is an old person. No one can escape from aging. And I would have to think that probably Siddhartha may have seen an older person before. I mean, and of course, he's now 29 years old. He's no longer a baby. But there was somehow in that moment, some of the dream of enchantment kind of dissolved, and it pierced him like a surgeon with a scalpel. It was a piercing, and I realized there was truth to this, and it shook him. No one can escape from aging. There's a moment of waking up. And so this very much humbled him, and he went back eventually to the palace, and yeah, this kind of stayed with him some, and at the same time, the pleasure palaces were in full whatever, and it's just so, you know, things are just so seductive and feel so good and just have a good time. And so he got lost in these worlds again for a while. And the story goes, after a while, he again had this urge to go out into the kingdom and again called Chana. And they went out a second time into the kingdom, seeing different how people live in the marketplace and so forth, and then came across a person lying on the ground and was clearly very, very ill, coughing and bodily fluids and, you know, the whole deal. And Siddhartha said, who is this? And Chana said, this is a person that is very, very ill. And then said something like, no one can escape from illness. And again, just hearing that, there was, you know, he probably got sick. He's probably seen other people got ill, but somehow in that moment, again, like that scalpel, unmistakable, it was a piercing. It was an understanding of the truth of illness that nor he nor anyone could escape from. So again, this was a very powerful moment to begin to realize the truth of this. And he, you know, eventually, of course, went back to the palace, and this time he was, you know, feeling forlorn and like, wow, aging and illness, and what is this life? But, you know, again, the seduction of the palace and having a good time, he once again gradually got swept away and was doing what he was doing. But the story continues on, that again, I want to go back to the kingdom. There's been some powerful things there. I want to go back. And so Chan and him went back when the time was right. And there, another sign happened. He noticed this person on the ground motionless, and the skin was discolored. Looking closely, this person wasn't breathing. Siddhartha got his hand, put it on the person's arm, and it was cold to touch. For those of you that haven't felt a body, there's a certain cold that you'll know. And Siddhartha is saying, Jhana, what's in? Goes, this is death. No one can escape from death. It's a very powerful, again, like a scalpel, a piercing. And this really shook Siddhartha to his core. What is, if life is just going to be with aging, illness, and death, what is this life? There's a powerful teaching in the Dharma called the Five Remembrances, and says, I am of the nature to grow old. This is a practice that a number of us work with every day. I am of the nature to grow old, and I cannot escape from growing old. I am of the nature to have ill health, and I cannot escape having ill health. I am of the nature to die, and I cannot escape death. All that is dear to me and everyone I love are of the nature of change, and I cannot escape being separated from them. The fifth remembrance, it actually is a little bit hopeful, that my deeds are my closest companions. I am the beneficiary of my deeds. My deeds are the ground on which I stand. That perhaps as I become mindful, that I can begin to develop qualities to grow with wisdom. But this piercing left Siddhartha, this truth of death left him again very forlorn. And this time coming back to the palace, he, no matter how much people were saying, hey, let's go here, let's do this, let's do that, like he didn't have any taste for this now. He understood deeply this truth. The truth of death. From the path of purification, as though huge mountains made of rock, so vast they reach up to the sky, were to advance from every side, grinding beneath them all that lives. So age and death roll over all. Warriors, priests, merchants, craftsmen, the outcasts, the scavengers, crushing all beings, sparing none. And here no troop of elephants, no charioteers, no infantry, no strategy in the form of spells, no riches can serve to beat them off. This is how death should be recollected. So these are powerful teachings that I'm sharing with you today. But they're powerful because they wake us up. And you can see now with Siddhartha, he was shook to his core. What am I going to do? What is this life? Eventually, he went out one more time, because I mentioned four heavenly messengers. And again, the word heavenly might seem a bit of a misnomer. What's so heavenly about aging, illness, and death? But it's heavenly in that, again, it wakes us up. There's a Pali term called, in Burmese Pali, thamweka. And it means just one word, but it's got a lot to this one word. It says, when you realize that death can come at any moment, it catapults you into a sense of spiritual urgency about what is this life. So you could say that Siddhartha had thamweka and steroids. What is this life if it's going to end like this? And so on this fourth outing, he's out again seeing people in the marketplace and doing this and that. And then he saw somebody walk by very slowly, gently, heedfully, peacefully, had robes on. And Siddhartha said, who is this person? I have never seen a person like this before. There's such a sense of serenity, calmness, wakefulness. Who is this? And Chana said, this is a sadhu. This is a person dedicating their life to understanding the meaning of life. When Siddhartha heard that, he knew deep in his heart, maybe there is a way to understand more about this life. With aging, illness, and death, and separation. And he realized, as he went back to the palace, that he needed to leave the palace. He wanted to become a sadhu, to go on this journey to understand the meaning of life. I'm going to put a little pause to that story and might pick up on it again later. What I want to share is that you may not have framed it and thought about it in this way, but I really do feel that every single one of us here, no exception, has met these messengers. And perhaps that's what's brought us here. Like, what is it that brought us to such a thing that you wanted to begin to look in? Carl Jung says, who looks outside dreams? Who looks inside awakens? The Spanish poet Antonio Machado says, some say it's good to dream, and others say it's better to live. But best of all, my friend, is to awaken. Waking up. And I want to just affirm that for all of us here, we may have met these messengers in one way or another that brought us on to the path. And in this next walking meditation, I really want to invite you, a little bit of a different walk, like a recollective type of walk, to reflect upon your own journey. What messengers have touched you of illness, of aging, of death, or teachers that touched your heart, that opened you, that maybe there's another way? I won't go into the whole story now because I know a number have heard it, but there was this moment with the fourth heavenly messenger, my teacher, and I've had many teachers, been blessed with many teachers through my life, in teachings. Some people, some just looking at life. Some people that I know, some people that, well, I just love the way Mother Teresa touched my heart, and she's one of my teachers too. But in particular, I remember after flunking out of college and being readmitted back on a warning, and I was so confused and lost in my life. And, you know, I grew up during the Vietnam War and a lot of social just unrest is just a crazy time. And, you know, and also I was dealing with a lot of death. I shared with you about awakening to the truth of that I and anyone could die when I was 4 years old. And sadly to say, between the age of 4 and 9, I lost my brother, who died of an illness. We shared a room together. Lost my best friend, who lived across the street. I lost my grandfather, who lived downstairs in our two-family house. So this was a time during these years, very lost and confused, but I'll never forget, after being readmitted back on warning, and my mother was begging me, is there a class that you would find interesting? And somehow I looked at this name of one class, the Wisdom of the East. Then there was a colon, and there was a whole bunch of words after that. I couldn't even pronounce them. I didn't even know what they were. Now I know. It said Buddhism, Taoism, Hinduism, and Zen. But at the time, I couldn't even pronounce it and didn't even know what they were. But the Wisdom of the East spoke to me. See, even as a young child, I've always been drawn to the East. And I'll never forget going to this class, and my teacher was sitting on top of his desk in a full lotus position. Never had a teacher like that before. It's like Hogwarts. And I just remember him looking at each student that came in, truly looking into their eyes and welcoming them. And the first book that he had us look at was, and to go into deeply, was the Tao Te Ching by Lao Tzu. And I had never been exposed to any of this type of way of looking at the world. And I just couldn't believe it when I began reading the Tao Te Ching. It like spoke to me like nothing ever spoke to me ever before. I couldn't believe that someone actually thought about life in this way. It opened up a whole universe inside me. I'm very grateful to Lao Tzu, who wrote the Tao Te Ching. And particularly, there was this one epigram. There's actually 81 different epigrams or poems, and I love them all. But particularly epigram number 47, sometimes I would read these, and I'd read them over and over and over again, trying to figure out, what is Lao Tzu saying? What is he really saying? So this one was, there's no need to look outside your window, for everything you need to know is inside you. And I kept reading it over and over again because I was just so lost and so confused. There's no need to look outside your window, for everything you need to know is inside you. And I just read this over and over again. I thought about it, contemplated upon it, and it took a really long time to all of a sudden realize, oh, what Lao Tzu is talking about is to look inside yourself. If you want to know something, look inside. And honestly, up to that point, I didn't have a clue, being just so lost and actually a lot of grief and despair and lots of stuff. And that was really the beginning of this journey of going inside. This journey of going inside, there's such I've read this so many times, and it's from Pablo Neruda, that speaks about what would it be like if the whole world just stopped for 12 seconds. And I'm just going to read a few lines from this poem called Keeping Quiet. It's a Chilean poet. And he says, if we were not so single-minded about keeping our lives moving and for once could do nothing, perhaps this huge silence might interrupt this sadness of never understanding ourselves and of threatening ourselves with death. Perhaps the earth can teach us when everything seems to be dead in winter and later proves to be alive. If we were not so single-minded about keeping our lives moving and for once could do nothing, perhaps this huge silence might interrupt this sadness of never understanding ourselves. And that's what we're doing here. We're entering into the huge silence, so that perhaps in time we begin to understand ourselves, to begin to see more clearly into our hearts, into our stories, our narratives, our conditionings, our identifications that can keep us so locked in. Beginning to wake up, beginning to understand these stories and narratives and identifications, and perhaps being held as hostage by them. So we're entering into this huge silence so that we can begin to understand ourselves and how ennobling this practice is, so ennobling to this willingness to sit and to be with ourselves, which is not easy at all. And you know that. You've been sitting with yourself all day. Who's been your messengers? That teacher, Bill Jackson was his name, at this small little state college in the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont, introducing me to the Tao Te Ching, my beloved Burmese Seros, Lhendit Sero, Tampulu Sero, Pakoku Sero, Rina Sirkar, Bishop Nipu Seyaku, on and on the list goes. My beloved wife, kids, family, friends. There's so many teachers. Who's been your teachers? But particularly those that, like, with the, they really helped you to get onto your path. They're inside you. They're living inside you. Who's been your teachers? Who's been your messengers that have helped to awaken you? So there's that sense of, as we move in this journey, we're bringing our hearts with us in our practice. And I love what Patrick Overton says, that when I come to the edge of all that I know, and I step off into the abyss of the unknown, I will trust one of two things to happen. That I will find some firm ground to stand upon, or I'll be taught to fly. I'll find some firm ground to stand upon, or I'll be taught to fly. So who's been your messengers that have touched you? They're like our benefactors. It is said that when some of you have seen prostrations to the Buddha, and it represents 5 points, the head, the 2 arms, and the 2 legs touching the ground, and represents the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha, our mother and father, because we wouldn't be here without them. And the last is our teachers. These are our 5 great benefactors in life. So I'm going to just end with another reading from Mary Oliver. And I've never heard her say that this was the answer to her question, tell me, what is it that you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? So I'm making this up as a possible. Maybe she would say that this was an answer to that question or not. This was a poem that was written many years later, and it's called To Begin With the Sweet Grass. But to me, it speaks of, I don't know, in some way I kind of perceive it as answering that question. So this is after many years. And she says, will the hungry ox stand in the field and not eat of the sweet grass? Will an owl bite off its own wings? Will a lark forget to lift its body in the air or to forget to sing? Will rivers run upstream? Behold, I say, behold, the reliability and the finery and the teachings of this gritty earth gift. Eat bread and understand comfort. Drink water and understand delight. Visit the garden where the scarlet trumpets are opening their bodies for the hummingbirds who are drinking the sweetness and who are thrillingly gluttonous. For one thing leads to another. Soon you'll notice how stones shine underfoot, and eventually tides will be the only calendar you'll believe in. For one thing leads to another. Soon you will notice how stones shine underfoot, and eventually tides will be the only calendar you'll believe in, and someone's face, someone whom you love, will be like a star, both intimate and ultimate. And you will both be heart-shaken and respectful. And you will hear the ear itself like a beloved whisper, oh, let me for a while longer enter the 2 beautiful bodies over your lungs. What I loved in the beginning, I think, was mostly myself, because never mind that I had to, because somebody had to. That was many years ago. Since then, I've gone out from my confinements, though with difficulty. I mean the ones that thought to rule my life. I cast them out. I put them on the mush pile. They will be nourishment somehow. Everything is nourishment somehow or another. And I have become the child of the clouds and of hope. I have become the friend of the enemy, whoever that is. I have become older, and cherishing what I have learned, I have become younger. And what do I risk to tell you all this, which is all that I know, is to love yourself and then forget it, and then to love the world. And just very lastly, from Tsongkhapa, the human body at peace with itself is more precious than the rarest of gems. The human body at peace with itself is more precious than the rarest of gems. This life so precious. May all beings discover the gateways into their hearts to grow with greater wisdom and compassion, and may there be peace. So thank you all very much. And yeah, let this be a time of walking to reflect upon these messengers and also particularly the fourth one that's helped you to brought you onto the path that maybe there's a way here. Begin to enter into this huge silence so that we can begin to make more peace, to make it more understand ourselves and our hearts. It's within us. So thank you very much, and we'll have a walk, and then that's going to segue into a bell that's going to ring in a half hour for supper. So thank you, and then we'll return again for the next sit at 6:45, but of course the bells will be guiding us all. So thank you so much, and I will say right away, it's going to take me a while to get out of here, so feel free to... leave before the teachers leave, or at least me anyways. So thank you.